Today's program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. For more information, visit www.rt11.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink, brought to you live on heritageradionetwork.org. I am Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink, and also the beverage director of Del Anima Lartuzzi and Anfor in the West Village, and the brand new La Picha restaurant over in the East Village. I'm extremely excited today. You know, we've been taping here over at Roberta's for a little while now, and the last few weeks I've been coming through and just noticing, oh wow, Roberta's is kind of stepping up their game. There's more interesting wine. There's some really cool artisanal grappa on the back bar. Like, something's going on here. So I'm really just absolutely excited and enthusiastic to be here with Amanda Smeltz, the beverage director of the brand new beverage director of Roberta's. She's 1 month in. Thanks
it's
so
true.
Much.
Hi, Joe.
Hi. Welcome. So Amanda, I'm just curious as to what's going on. I'm noticing that, you know, some of my really favorite producers, like, you have Palo Bayo wines, some really cool artisanal. The Capovilla Grappa is probably the only real artisanal, or one of the few artisanal grappas that we can see here in the States.
So. Yeah, totally. Well, I think Roberta's is an amazing, amazing sort of stomping ground for experimental stuff and for things that are a little off the beaten path, while also nodding to technique and tradition. The cooking is a lot like that here. The pizza is like that. You know, people come in and they're like, oh, pizza and beer. And then they realize that, you know, holy crap, this pizza isn't quite normal pizza, you know? So I think there's an opportunity here with every avenue, whether it's beer or spirits or whatever, to have things that are a little off the beaten path, but that also really nod to things that are well made. So there's some, I'm starting to filter some producers in who I treasure personally very much.
And so who were some of the first producers? You're like, I can't wait to have these on the list.
Well, I was super stoked because Bayo was already here, but I really want to bring in some of his sort of more obscure wines. Some orange wine has for whatever reason, a really big hold on the staff. So I'm looking forward to, bringing in La Stopa, who are female winemakers out of Emilia Romagna that I really like. And I'm actually going to move the list away from all Italian and into the domestic kind of world. Again, the domestic grappas you saw, but there are some winemakers in California I cherish, Donkey and Goat, Katuri, some other guys that I plan on bringing around. So,
very cool.
Yep.
I'm going to ask you about those domestic producers in a minute, but you distinguish that the La Stopa wines are made by a female winemaker. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that that's important, or is that a particular interest of yours?
Yeah, it's pretty crucial. I mean, given the history of land ownership in Europe, and just, you know, general sort of gender issues, having females who own their own plots of land and also are vinifying themselves, I think really does come to bear because, you know, it's my understanding, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that genetically women have a really strong chemical sense with smell. They have, I hear, supposedly stronger senses of smell than men. So this is like a big deal in Burgundy right now that there are female winemakers who are coming out and making these really refined wines. And the men are sort of like, you know, give us our land back, this kind of thing. So, so yeah, I think it's pretty crucial. It's nice to see the whole wine world kind of being gender equalized with some time. So, yeah.
Yeah. You know, that's something that you hear a lot in the wine industry, that women have a more in tune sense of smell. And, I didn't know if that was a folklore.
It may well be. I'm sure that there are plenty of men who have incredibly sensitive noses, clearly, yeah. But it's still kind of, it's fun to bat around, I suppose.
You know what I always suppose is that a lot of times being a good wine taster is not just having a really sensitive nose, but being able to articulate what it is that you're feeling.
Mm-hmm. There's a ability to link up what you encounter sort of in the sensate way with how you verbalize and how you're able to name. I think a lot of what people get intimidated by with wine is vocabulary. A lot of it is just like, how do I talk about what I'm sensing? Because everyone has a nose and everyone has a very keen nose. You know, we're kind of like dogs that way. But the difference is that we can articulate about what we're smelling and dogs can't do that. You know what I mean? So yeah, vocabulary and linking things up is a crucial skill, I believe.
That perhaps women are more in tune with what they're feeling.
I mean, I don't want to make sweeping generalizations, but you know.
All right, that's interesting. Who are some of your other favorite female wine producers?
Oh man, I have yet to meet her, but there's a woman who runs a winery called Whitethorn who totally changed my mind about Chardonnay in California, making a really restrained, and I haven't seen it for a while, I think it's such small production, making a really restrained Chardonnay that's just like, I wouldn't have known, you know what I mean, about that grape. Who are others that I really like? Oh, the Lini Lambrusco producer. I have a big boner for Emilia Romagna right now, too, so that's like where my eyes are at, but the Lini producer.
And I have one for Alicia Lini.
Okay, great. Yeah. we're in tandem here. Her wines are tremendous. And again, sort of like returning me to a belief in Lambrusco and the whole, and that whole style of wine. Yeah, there are far more out there. I believe Moray's Burgundies are made by a female winemaker, and they're stunning. They're like, knock it out of the park.
Mounieray.
And I'm going to blank on her name as well. Nicole. Her first name is Nicole in the Jura, making wines from Montbourgo. She has a plot of land called L'Etoile that has little starfish fossils in the soil. She is like amazing, amazing.
So much exciting stuff happening there.
Yeah, it's cool.
And my favorite's Elisabetta Foradori. To me, she does no wrong.
Yeah.
She's just the best. And then, so who are some of these domestic producers? I know we share a mutual friend with Jared Brand of Donkey and Goat.
Yeah, Jared and Tracy are amazing. I think they've done so much for Bay Area wine culture. They've got such a strong... I was out in San Francisco for a couple months this summer, and they've got such a strong presence there. You know, there's a natural wine bar in Oakland, and they like, you know, they're there regularly, and... They're just so cool. They just started doing it in the Negociant style in a garage, and now, you know, a couple years later, with a couple singular Syrahs, they've established themselves as, you know, kind of pioneers, but without like setting up to do so, I think, necessarily. So they're rad. I went and saw Tony Katuri, whose wines are very polarizing, I know, in the fall, and fell completely in love, if I wasn't already. Really, really, you know, it's in the middle of Sonoma, his house, and so... You drive up there and there's massive redwoods and it's really hard to get around the trees. The roads are so thin and you see all of these incredibly impeccably clean vines everywhere. It's Sonoma, you know, there's tons of vines and they're all very well trained, very clean. And then you sort of like turn the bend and get onto Tony's land and it's just like overrun. There are cats and dogs everywhere and the Zinfandel that's on his estate is... You can hardly see that it's grapes because there's so much other crap growing along with it. And it's gnarled and old and really wild looking. And I was really kind of moved by that. So those are two that I definitely have my eyes on.
So how do you distinguish that like overgrown vineyard? Mm-hmm. How do you distinguish the level of lack of care and laziness with beautiful, you know, polyculture?
If Tony Katuri were in this room, he'd probably run us over with one of his Harleys. how do I distinguish? I think the ones who are doing it really, really well, I think of Olivier Umbrecht, who isn't, to my knowledge, working like biodynamically or anything, but I've heard him talk about the way he cares for his vines in the field, and it's so incredibly attentive. But I know he also doesn't do a lot of the more contemporary like vine training or you know, treatments, some of the more scientific processes. He doesn't engage with many of them. And, you know, little anecdotes about going out to warm the grapes at night when it's getting particularly cold with tiny fires. You know, like this stuff is, I mean, that's clearly a level of care that, I don't know, it's like raising children or something. I'm sure that there are winemakers who try to make wine just by like letting things go totally nuts and then they don't check in.
Right.
But I don't think the good ones are like that.
So the more care that you have in the vineyard, the less you have to worry about in the winery.
Yeah. Good fruit, good wine, that kind of thing.
Good fruit. this way, you know, if you raise your kids, you don't have to, well, you don't have to worry about them in college. They're not going to
go
all Lindsay Lohan
exactly.
on you.
Good, good babies, no Lindsay Lohan. That's, I think.
So you've been through a couple of openings as well. John mm-hmm. Dory, the Breslin.
Yep.
We just went through our opening at La Picho, so this topic's fresh on my mind.
Man,
can you describe...
It is a special time in the restaurant world.
Describe what it's like so that... that my friends and my girlfriend know why I don't respond to their phone
Well, this
calls.
One goes out to Joe's lady. It is a really hard time. Opening a restaurant is a really, really hard time. It's incredibly invigorating. It's very different when you are involved in ownership or management, too, because you're asked to design the ship. Like, you're going to run the thing. You have to kind of set the tone early on. And that can be incredibly challenging when you're just trying to make sure you have enough silverware for service. You know, like there are basic functionalities that really consume a lot of attention. You know, when you're opening a restaurant as a wine guy or a somm or whatever, and you're like, where's my wine? You know, or like, we don't have a bin system figured out, or what are people even going to drink here? Or, do we have the proper glassware? You know, we only have 4 burgundy glasses and they break every shift. You know, this stuff. It's just a mess for a while. Mm-hmm. And I think it takes many months for a restaurant to find its groove, and they're organic things because they're very people-based. So they, you know, they need a lot of continued attention, much like grapes. They're never done. The work's never done. We were just talking about how you could work 12 hours and look at your watch and be like, oh my God, I didn't do any of the things I wanted to do. I guess that's common, but yeah. So, I mean, I know at the Breslin, it was a couple months before I really felt like I knew what was going on at all, you know.
So were there some wines there that you guys were sure, like, oh, people are totally going to drink this, and then you couldn't sell them at all, and vice versa?
Yeah,
were there wines people were just
asking
for?
It was funny because they didn't really have a wine director at first, and my friend Carlo Zuski took the program over, and then about a weekend was like, holy crap, this is so big, we need another person. So I was like, well, you know. I've done wine stuff. I can be a somm for you. And we found that there was a whole back inventory of wine that just maybe lacked a little inspiration and, you know, kind of, but I remember the initial review said standard Oregon Pinots, which was a little bit of a dig, I think. I don't know, because Oregon makes beautiful wine. But there's just so much back inventory to work through. And that's a thing that I'm seeing at Roberta's too, even though this restaurant's been here for 4 or 5 years. It's like, okay, there's someone had an idea of what wine is appropriate for the restaurant. And now that there are other people with their hands on it, we have to see if we can proceed with some personality, you mm-hmm. know, and to really back farmers and winemakers who we think are doing a tremendous job. And that can take some time. You got to sell the stuff, you know? So it's a ton of work. It's a lot of research, but God, it's fun research, you know?
Yeah. And so what do you think was the impetus here, to step things up? Does it have anything to do with Blanco opening and the extra attention?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that ball really got rolling about a year ago when we had here at Roberta's a very kind and rightfully so review, from Mr. Sam Sifton, that just exploded the attention to this restaurant, and it was a tribute to the quality of the cooking that's happening here. You know, head chef Carlo and chef de cuisine Max Sussman, they just do an amazing job. I had a buddy come and visit just a couple weeks ago, new to the city, and he was like, it's amazing to see the kinds of techniques that are happening in the cooking out in Bushwick. And I was like, yeah, man, it doesn't have to happen in the Upper West Side. It doesn't have to happen in Columbus Circle. You know, that kind of cooking can happen anywhere, especially when you have passionate people. You can make it work in a really janky space, you know? So I think given that attention and given, you know, the new project at Blanca, which is bizarre, you know, like a tasting menu restaurant all the way out here. And, it's awesome. it's, you know, just kind of unprecedented, I think, especially for the area, but also for what people think of when it comes to that formal of dining. So there's an opportunity here to continue to massage the wine program along with that. And as people are spending a lot of time continuing to pay attention to the cooking and so on here, they're also beginning to really pay attention to what mm-hmm. they're drinking.
And so you said the staff's really excited about orange wine right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
they've got the greatest tastes.
That, you know, at our restaurants, at least, whatever the crew's most excited about is what we sell. Because I'm not selling you know, wine to every single table.
Of course.
How do you get them excited about wines that you're interested in?
Man, they do it themselves for the most part. There's an amazing, like, it's so funny. The hipster staff at Roberta's, they're not hipsters at all here. And I don't know if that's like a recent development. They're actually really savvy, really lovely people. And they have great taste. They've got young sort of, I don't know, eccentric tastes, which is cool. They don't have like an old traditionalist framework when it comes to thinking about wine. And so they're down to try whatever. You can put old Barolo in front of them, or you can put crazy Roussanne Marsanne with skin maceration from Berkeley in front of them. And they regard it with the same attention, you know? So I think all you have to do is assist with vocabulary, do a little digging and find the stuff that's worth being excited about. And it catches like wildfire, you know? So it's a good staff for that to happen with.
All right, and on that note, we're going to do a little bit more digging when we get back from break. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org.
You're listening to Curse by Controller on heritageradionetwork.org.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today. The following program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 Potato Chips dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believes comfort food should be just that. Know where your food comes from. For more information, visit rt11.com.
All right, and we're back with In the Drink here on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm Joe Cavanelli here with Amanda Smeltz, the beverage director at Roberta's. And we're back. I just wanted to ask you a little bit about your book that's about to come out in February. Amanda's also a poet. So can you tell us a little bit about what you have working up?
Yeah, sure. Normally, I'm very bashful about this subject, so I can't believe I offered it up. But I have a book of poems coming out that's entitled Imperial Bender, on a small press publisher based out of Louisville, Kentucky. They are super rad. They're called Typecast Publishing. They're an imprint that focuses very much on design. They do all letterpress publications. Their books are absolutely beautiful. They're like art objects themselves. And they have published a couple. They're relatively new, just about 5 years old, to my understanding. But they've published a couple poets whose work I really admire. And so my book got picked up by them, and it is in process right now.
And can you tell us a little bit about the subject material?
Man, it's hard. When, you know, you title something Imperial Bender, and it, yeah, I should hope some things come to mind. There's a lot. A buddy of mine, a bartender friend of mine, sort of read an early version of the manuscript, and he made a joke about the first poem. He said, "Smeltz, you should have just titled it Booze in all caps." And I was like, well, I guess that is a main thread that runs through it, huh? I mean, it's hard when you work in restaurants and the beverage industry and you spend a lot of time having your imagination captured by wine and winemaking and the geography of it and the anthropology of it. It's hard to not have that seep in, you know, to a lot of the things that you do. So in Imperial Bender, there are definitely a ton of references to different parts of the world where wine is made and different aspects of restaurant life. And but a lot of it is about, you know, my relationships and different things that I was going through in the period in which the book was being written. So,
and how do you find that your interest as in poetry and as a writer affects your professional career?
It affects it a lot, believe it or not. It's sort of indirect, but there's overlap. An old friend of mine who was one of the first people to get me into wine and to start teaching me about it said, this was the thing that caught me, said that wine is anthropology. And by this, he meant, as you come to learn how these grapes grow, where they grow, and who tends them, and then who brings them into being as wine, you realize that there's an intensely human element to it. And that as your knowledge grows, you begin to see stylistic imprints of the human hands that either raise the fruit or tend it, you know, or who make the wine or who distribute and import the wine, you know. Or then people like you and I who pick things to try to share with other people. You just realize there's so much to do with humans in this grape and this fruit. And that comes to bear because in poetry, you're constantly thinking about your way. You're constantly thinking, and B, you're constantly thinking about people, I think, and the way the mind works and the way it's influenced by the environment around it. And you come to see a funny link between people and grapes. As cheesy as that sounds, there comes to be overlap.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I'm really curious to. I think I know the answer to this question, but I'm curious to hear what you have to say about it. The idea of terroir and that wine should taste like it's from a specific place. I personally feel that the human element or the anthropological element, maybe in your words, is a part of that terroir equation.
Absolutely. Humans are terroir too. You know, I don't think we spend a lot of time thinking about it as Americans necessarily, but we very much are a product of where we come from, you know, and what ground we're raised on. We are like grapes in that way, you know, and if a winemaker comes in with a very heavy hand and does a lot of stuff to, you know, a lot of junk to the grapes, it can turn out bad. Sometimes it can be fine. And then there are some grapes that do really well when the winemaker is super hands off. I think people are like that, you know, and our childhoods are like that, and our places where we're born and raised are like that, and our cultures are, you know, I feel like landscape is super important to people. And I know that grapes are the same way because, you know, we're all sort of from the same dirt. So.
And tell us about a little bit about the landscape out here in Bushwick. What do you find that people are drinking?
God, I love it. what's the landscape like in Bushwick? Well, they ask for beer first, and then after they're done drinking beer, people are adventurous out here. I think people who live here, especially people who have been here for a while, like not who aren't recent implants, are totally happy being on the fringe. This is, you know, the super industrial neighborhood appeals to some. It appeals to me very much. And as such, they're totally happy to explore things that are fringe themselves, you know. It's a fairly young area. And so there's, like I said, not necessarily a ton of traditionalist approaches to wine, which is a bummer because, you know, you miss out on Burgundy and Barolo and stuff, but then you also explore these sort of unknown pockets. And I think there's a really big attentiveness to that in this neighborhood, and it's cool.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
That's very cool. Is there anything that you've seen yet that you're super jazzed about that you haven't been able to move? And for me, it's sherry, and we'll talk about sherry after. I wish people would drink more sherry. It's sherry week. We're having a sherry dinner tonight at Le Picho. I think there's 3 seats left with Lou Stau and Fernando de Castilla. Cool. But we can't sell. It's so hard to sell it at the restaurants, no matter how much I love it.
Dude, I was just at Hearth and Terroir last night with some friends of friends, and they're working in like very commercial wineries in California. And I was like, you know, let's get a glass or two of sherry. And they, you know, immediately had the standard reaction, which is, you know, gross. That stuff is cloying and awful. And my grandmother drinks it. And of course, that was my response too years ago when I first encountered it. And then you come to find that there's an incredible range of variety. So I got like four different glasses and sat it down. I was like, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to have a small sherry flight right now. And they loved it. You know, they, there was a Valdespino, one of their particular Olorosos that I tasted with them, and they just couldn't believe it. They're like, it smells like maple syrup. It smells like it's going to be, you know, caramel coated walnuts, and it's dry as a bone. I'm like, that's the beauty of this thing, right? It's super complex.
And that's someone in the industry who didn't know that sherry.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Right. This is a guy working in vineyards who had no idea, you know, yeah, that's so sherry definitely, but whatever, I'm bringing it in here anyway. We're gonna make it happen. Grappa is so hard, which is again such a bummer, because it's a man, is that cool booze. It's just people are super scared by having had lousy, you know, stuff of it, and it, you know, it is fire water. You have to be okay with high octane booze. Yeah, and then there are just some wines that don't get the kind of love that they should. You know, I think Paolo Bea is one of the most inspired winemakers alive, maybe. And Sagrantino is kind of a scary grape. And the tannins in his wines can be a little bit alarming to people. So that's why we have his sort of entry-level blend here, to give the least intimidating. I mean, people don't believe me when I'm chatting with guests and I'm like, now listen, like, this wine will actually be a dragon and attack your teeth. Like, you gotta go with me here. And they're like, oh, no, it's fine. And then they taste it and they're like, oh, holy cow. Maybe we should have, you know, maybe a Pinot would have been the better answer or something. You know, so there are wines that it's a harder time to, you've got about 45 seconds on the restaurant floor to explain to people what they are and why they might like them. And then they want to go back to their dinner, you know, so some things stay in the cellar for a while. But it's a good task. It's a good challenge.
Hey guys, we actually got a Twitter question I want to pipe in with from a guy named Doug. He wants to ask Amanda, is it hard avoiding having a wine list top heavy with Italian in a place like Roberta's?
Yes. So part of that is that the previous wine director was building a really beautiful list of all Italian wines. And I think that comes from the kind of traditional notion of, you know, it's pizza, you drink Chianti. You know, pizza and red wine, pizza and Lambrusco. I can't tell you how much Lambrusco we sell, which is cool because it means I get to have awesome Lambrusco in here. But it's a lot of old perceptions about what goes with pizza prevail. But like I was saying before, it's not standard Italian food here by any means, and it's not standard pizza by a long shot. So standard pizza pairings kind of don't hold. However, the wines of Italy are so diverse and varied from region to region, it seems mile to mile, town to town, that it is so hard not to be fully in love with them. They're fascinating, and the grape varietals are fascinating, and I find myself needing to stop buying them because they're so great. But I also have a passion for domestic wine, and I think that's got a place at Roberta's and in Brooklyn in particular. You know, American wine that's made well with care, with sort of some of the old world techniques. Man, we've got amazing land. So I'm working on it. I'm working on restraining my Italian hand and moving other parts of the world forward here. It can take a second.
Wow, very cool. Thanks. Thanks for the question. I think that might be our first Twitter question to come through.
I'm so into it.
what's the handle?
Sorry, Doug Trapasso, which is at Demilove.
Everyone follow at Demilove.
And Doug, you're going to get so many follows today.
Say nice things to at Demilove. He's a cool guy. All right. We have just a few more minutes. Something that we like to do here is do a little quick rapid fire question. And basically, I'm going to give you a scenario, and you're going to tell me what would be your ideal wine in that scenario.
I'm into it.
You're into it. Okay, so when I saw you this morning walking through Roberta's, you were enjoying your Murray's bagel.
So delicious. Does Murray's have a Twitter handle? Can we get Murray's on the line?
If you were to have any wine with a Murray's bagel, what would you have?
Oh man, it depends. If you're having the jalapeno cream cheese, probably not much. Or dessert wine. With the bagel that I was having today, which was a plain bagel with scallion cream cheese, I would say probably champagne. And I'm particularly liking the Peau Simonet champagnes right now. Super clear. Singing clarity. Not a lot of dosage, really restrained champagnes, but perky and awake. Yeah. That is what I need in the morning, is to be perky and awake with champagne.
So how about if you're in a park or lying on a hill reading a book of poetry?
La ti da.
I'm sure you do that every
day. It's not that romantic. It really isn't. Probably sherry. Probably Fino. Really nice Fino.
Fino, something that is...
A little saline, not too aggressive, coastal. Yeah.
All right. And how about a party in Bushwick in some industrial space that's converted to a really cool non-hipster party?
Lambrusco all day. Lini Lambrusco all day, every day.
Awesome.
Yeah, party wine.
Well, thank you so much, Amanda Smeltz. What a pleasure this has been to chat with you. And I am just so excited. I've been getting more excited every week just walking through and doing the show.
That's great to hear. Thanks, Joe.
Seeing some of my favorite wines. So come check out Roberta, say hi to Amanda, and we'll talk to you next week on In the Drink. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.